from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you, and by support from the Central Indiana Community Foundation, the Indiana Arts Commission, a state agency, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, a federal agency.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll chat with photographer David Bartley.
I'll catch up with conceptual artist Emily Kinnert.
And I'll talk with journalist Dan Carpenter about his new book of poetry. Plus, there's our arts calendar we call What'll We Do?
All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Indianapolis photographer David Bartley wants you to look up and look around. And that's not only his advice, it's the name of his new exhibit on view at the Holiday Park Nature Center. David describes the exhibit as a pictorial journey to remote areas and a view of the abundant beauty right here in Indianapolis. Sharon Gamble invited David into the studio to learn about his photographic technique and what inspires him.
All right, technical stuff first. What kind of camera do you use? Are you shooting digital? Are you shooting old-fashioned film? Does it matter? You shoot sometimes one and sometimes the other?
It's digital. It's a pretty basic digital camera. I mean, it's got a decent zoom lens. It's a Panasonic with a Lumix lens, which has good low lighting capabilities. But it's really not that fancy. I've been pretty much exclusively digital now for about 5 years. And I never really thought I would get to even that point.
I was going to ask, did you resist making that transition?
Yeah, well, I think if you get a good enough digital camera, then you'll be really happy with it, because it'll feel just like, you know, your normal film camera, and it's much easier to get exactly the image you want, because, you know, you can sort of do your own digital darkroom. So that's been really nice for me. And also knowing before you leave the site, if you got the shot that you wanted, so.
Oh, sure. You don't have to just keep your fingers crossed and wait for the darkroom.
Right, yeah, sometimes it would turn out and sometimes it wouldn't, so, and that's kind of an expensive risk, you know, when you're just shooting a lot of film, so.
How did you get started? When did you first pick up a camera, or when did someone first hand you one and say, you'd be good at this, you should try this?
Well, I don't know if I'm good at it yet. I'm still trying, but, yeah, I've always been involved in, you know, various creative pursuits, and, you know, my day job is an editor, and this is just something, I spend a lot of time outdoors when I'm not at work, and, you know, so photography for me is just sort of a natural extension of the time I spend with nature, and so, you know, I've always had a camera, and I've just been gradually getting, you know, a better camera, and a camera that I think will serve the purpose of getting the shots that I want, so, you know, more or less seriously at it for about 15 years.
That's a long time.
Yeah, and it sort of takes a long time, even when you get to a point where, you know, I've now taken a lot of photographs. I've been to a lot of places. I know what to look for. I know the sorts of things I'm trying to find. And then, you know, sort of making that leap to exhibiting your photography is a whole new learning curve. So I'm about a year and a half into that part of it.
What surprised you when you first made that leap into exhibiting?
I think maybe my biggest surprise is how encouraging everybody has been. Just keep at it. Just do what drives you, and just keep trying. And there are places, you know, that you can exhibit your photographs. And I think that the biggest hurdle is just sort of overcoming your own reservations about even trying something new. So I think that maybe the biggest surprise has just been how rewarding it's been, and how gratifying it is to, you know, find places that are interested in exhibiting my photographs and having people appreciate them.
Is there an internal conflict between your day job and your love of photography? A favorite author once wrote that his propensity to edit sometimes outran his propensity to write, and I wonder if you ever pull back and say, oh, but this isn't perfect, so maybe I'll just delete this one. Or
no, I fortunately, I'm able to kind of release the editor side of me when I'm doing that, although it comes in very handy when you do know exactly what you want. You sort of, you know, take the photograph. A lot of it is, of course, the timing and being there for the moment that you want to capture. Then when you have all those images and you go into, you know, I get on the computer and I start fooling around with them, I try really not to alter them very much.
Do you have a philosophy of how much to retouch, how far to go in Photoshop or whatever you're using?
I pretty much try to capture everything in real natural light. I try to capture the real warm tones of, you know, whether it's a nature subject or the sky photography that I've been focusing on. So I hardly ever use a flash. If I do use a flash, I can't imagine a situation where I've even considered displaying that photograph. So I really do like, you know, you have to be very still. You have to have everything exactly how you want it. And then, you know, sometimes maybe with film photography, if you just took it to a photo lab, you might not get exactly what you want in those low light situations, because it'd be really difficult for even someone who was consciously preparing that film, developing that film, to sort of anticipate what you want, much less if it's a machine that's just sort of naturally setting levels. So I go in and I generally lighten up areas that would otherwise be blacked out, or possibly darken some areas to give richer tones to something that would be washed out in light.
But you're still using a very light hand. You don't want to...
No. And I think that what a lot of people think when they hear digital photography is, you know, you're going in there and you're just sort of fooling around with it on the computer and giving it, you know, some sort of filter effect. And, you know, that's sort of fun to do every once in a while. I've done that a little bit with portrait photography and things like that. But it's almost always an alternative to the original. And I think that still the most rewarding images are those that capture just the real natural light.
Back to natural light and nature. We happen to live in the same neighborhood, and we don't know each other well, but I've walked past your yard, and I have the impression that you've created a wildlife habitat in your yard. Is that true? Is that literally true?
It is literally true. We've been in our house for about 17 years, and we've planted a lot of trees. We've planted a variety of trees, and we've planted them in such a way that I would hope gives the impression that they just naturally grew there. Mm-hmm. It's a real natural sort of landscape. Recently I built a pond in the backyard, and so a combination of all those things eventually led to me just investigating, you know, making it a natural wildlife area, like as designated by the Natural Wildlife Federation. And it was funny, you know, it was an online form that I filled out, and, you know, you have to have a certain amount of variety of berries, you know, the fresh water from the pond, shelter, trees of different varieties, and, you know, everything came together, and so there it is, and it's, you know, it's legitimate. And I think, you know, the photographs that are in this exhibit at the Holiday Park Nature Center, really a testament to that. I mean, we live in a downtown neighborhood, and, you know, it's a remarkable array of nature that comes to our backyard. I mean, not to say all the photographs are from my backyard, but a lot of them are. And, I mean, you know, maybe you wouldn't expect to see a great blue heron in someone's backyard downtown, but it happens, and a variety of warblers, you know, flying squirrels, you know, things that you would think you might have to venture down to Brown County at least to see.
Yeah.
And it's all there. And I think that, you know, nature really is just seeking a certain specific variety of things. And that can be accomplished in a relatively small area.
We should probably throw in at this point that there is a home tour at the end of June of Historic Meridian Park, and you can walk by and see David's yard from the street.
Right.
Yeah. So you have you've taken a lot of photographs of the sky. How did that start?
Well, it's kind of interesting. The exhibit, it's been displayed in one other location before this, it became like sort of a photo, you know, photographs of clouds, photographs of sky, but the whole concept sort of gelled together in more of the idea of look up. So the exhibit is called Look Up. And interestingly enough, or perhaps a little bit ironically, the idea really started from looking down. I spent a fair amount of time on airplanes when I'm flying back and forth for business trips and things like that. And it always has amazed me how many people never look out the window, mm-hmm. And to me, it's a remarkable thing. I mean, of course, flying along the rim of the Rockies or over the ocean is a little bit more interesting than maybe the farmland quilted pattern in Iowa or something. But, the one thing that you just can't beat in the Midwest and the Great Lakes is the clouds. And so, I'm looking out the window and I'm thinking how many people never do this, how many people have never even had the opportunity to do this, and maybe except for me and a couple of kids, no one else is doing it. So
yeah.
So it's, it started from that, and I took a few shots, kind of out the window of some interesting, thunderheads and things like that. And then it sort of just gelled together with just the whole nature photography. And as a photographic subject, clouds and sky are really interesting because it's a really fleeting moment. I mean, what you see at that particular moment,
Be gone.
It's completely different, 5 seconds later. Hmm. So, but I think that it's also just a nice reminder to everyone. You think, here we are in Indiana. There's not an ocean. There's not mountains. Pretty unremarkable as far as, compared to maybe some national parks, but we do have beautiful skies here, and it's all year long, and it's very beautiful, and it's just nice to take a moment and look up and appreciate that. And some of these photographs, I think, really remind us that we just need to every once in a while pause and take a deep breath and look up and really appreciate the beauty that's around us right now. Yeah, it's good to get out and get in some open spaces and see something in the distance. And it really is, it is relaxing. I mean, it's nice because nice to have the reaction of people actually changing their behavior a little bit because of my photo exhibit. And that's where, I kind of think of it as in terms of, it's their photographs. It's not really art, it's not like I painted it, So the thing I think that makes it
But
art,
you captured it. You had the presence of mind to say this is worth a freeze frame.
Right, right. And that moment becomes a unique piece of art. And I think the other thing that helps it along there for me is it's more of a outlook, in a way, I think that the image hopefully is not only beautiful to people, but perhaps even gives them a reason to perhaps even consider changing the way that they think. And I think that's an important thing that art does. And so it's been rewarding to have people, see my photographs and understand what I'm doing and then stop and come up to me, in the middle of the day and say, hey, on the way to work today, I thought of you. I was on my way to work, and there were these big blue clouds rolling in the snowstorm. But the sunrise was just coming over the horizon, and it was just creating this real stark light. I said, I know exactly what you mean because I pulled over on the side of the road and took a picture of it. But it's nice to see other people.
You're creating community.
Yeah, and just sort of recognizing this that is around us all the time, and it's very easy to miss.
Sharon Gamble with photographer David Bartley, whose exhibition Look Up and Look Around is on view at the Holiday Park Nature Center through March 15th. You can meet David at the artist reception at the Nature Center next Sunday, January 17th, from 2 to 4 p.m. For more information, call 317-327-7180. Again, 327-7180.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. Indiana conceptual artist Emily Knurk graduated from Heron, where she also taught before going on to be the first living contemporary Indiana artist to be featured in a solo show at the Indianapolis Museum of Art when her work Suburban Nation opened in 2007. Knurk now teaches at the University of Las Vegas, but was back home again to talk about her current show with Love, Dessau on exhibit at Christopher West Presents. Travis chatted with Emily and with Christopher West about the show.
Emily, Chris, Happy New Year, and Emily, welcome back to Indianapolis.
Thank you.
Great to see you guys both here.
You too, Travis. Always a pleasure.
Things going well, Christopher West Presents, of
they
course.
They are. Yeah. They are. We're entering our fourth exhibition. I had to count for a second, but yeah, things are going great.
Good. Well, I am really excited about the new exhibition, With Love, Dessau, Emily Knurk. I enjoyed the show that you had at the IMA, Suburban Nation, back in 2007 so very much, and especially loved talking with you about it. So it's great to have you back in town and to hear about the new piece. Yeah. So welcome back from Vegas, and which I want to hear about in just a little bit. But let's talk about the current show. I must say, I was actually a little disappointed when I read the description. I thought maybe you were actually going to be doing a show about Vegas. So I hope that's coming soon. But this one is actually about sort of reflections in some ways on a trip you took to Germany, right?
Yeah, I spent the summer in Berlin, actually, traveling around, kind of recuperating from my first year in Vegas. And was just really inspired. I went to the Bauhaus in Dessau and spent a lot of time just looking at the architecture and some of the successes and failures. And I kind of was a little more interested in the failures.
You've had certainly an interest in previous work in looking at suburban life. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious how that drew you into what you were looking at in Germany.
Well, actually, I went away to Germany to really kind of just step back and kind of re-examine my inspirations. You know, I've done a lot with the suburbia and architecture, and now I'm living in Vegas, and, you know, where it's just absolutely bizarre architecture. And going to Berlin, I kind of just wanted to lighten up and look, have a new perspective on things. So, ironically, it wasn't until the end of the trip did I realize I had been documenting and drawing on some of the same formal qualities of maybe a suburban structure. What I was picking out as I thought purely formal was really completely related to what I was doing prior. So I thought I was on this whole new body of work.
And
while it is
variation on the same theme,
different and is expressed very differently. Some of the similar, I think Christopher would agree when he saw the work, that there's some similar themes coming up about boundaries and structures. So a little more abstracted, maybe.
Now, the work that you're looking at, the inspiration, the design inspiration you were looking at, the Bauhaus. Tell me just briefly about that for listeners who may not be familiar with that German style.
German style.
And movement.
It, you know, is a movement prior to pre-Nazi, and I knew it pretty much through Joseph Albers. That's kind of my experience when I went to Heron Art School. Mm-hmm. We studied a lot about color and design and formal issues, and talks a lot about form and function and these aspects.
The whole idea of form follows function.
Mm-hmm.
So now, when you realize that what you were documenting, what you were looking at, was in fact sort of connected to your previous work, at what point did you say, well, this needs to be a show? This needs to be turned into some new work?
You know, when you come back from a big trip where you do a bunch of work, you start editing, and at least I started editing and kind of looking at things in groups.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, you know, came together and thought this would be a nice show. And luckily, Christopher had said, hey, if you've got anything in the burner, let's chat. And I sent him a few images, and we went forward.
Chris, tell me what it was that drew you into wanting to have Emily at Christopher West Presents.
Well, one of the first calls that I made when I decided to open the gallery was to Emily and to say that we really need to do something. It's kind of, we've been talking about it for a long time. So it's really great to see this finally coming to fruition and having this happen. But Emily and I first met probably 5 or 6 years ago, and we really started talking in Chicago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
And I remember we were looking at museums, at galleries, and we went most of the day, and she never even mentioned her artwork. I had no idea she was an artist. And then she started opening her mouth and talking about her work, and I was like, okay, this is incredible. And so, like, ever since then, been a huge fan and really enjoyed following her work from her days in Chicago to her show at the IMA and now in Vegas. And she's just one of those ones that I definitely have made a point to stay in touch with along the way.
Emily, when you open your mouth and talk about your work, I also find it interesting. Not to put you too much on the spot here, but I know that for me personally, your show Suburban Nation, I really feel as though I appreciated so much more by having the chance to talk with you a bit before I went to go see it. And so I'm hoping that you can give us a little preview here of the show at Christopher West Presents. As far as I know, it's a mix of installation as well as drawings. What should we be looking for as an audience?
Well, I think in this show, it's a closer examination of boundaries and the human nature to create a boundary. I think, you know, some of the work at the IMA kind of hinted at that and was maybe not as direct. And I think this is a more microscopic view of, say, communal living, but then the human touch of a boundary. So I would say this next show is a lot about just spatial structures.
Are you looking at lines as boundary? I mean, it's often been said that, you know, lines don't really exist in nature, that, you know, that we create them. I mean, right. Is that sort of boundary or, more metaphorical boundaries?
I think in this show it's actually, pretty like the formal structure. You see a lot of physical lines, some that are drawn, some that are implied, some of the photos. You may have to look a little bit to really find them, but once you see them, you'll see them throughout the entire show.
Right, and I neglected to mention that there are photographs and sculpture as well. Now, the photographs, are these photographs that you took?
In Dessau.
In Dessau, in German, okay. So when we're looking at boundary, I mean, do you see it as, you know, as something that separates or something that organizes?
Well, I think the beauty of it is kind of both. I mean, it can separate, it can draw together. I mean, it's kind of this fluid structure that as humans we put together. It's just interesting how you can isolate one boundary and it can be a connection and others can separate. I don't know if that makes sense. But I think that it's kind of an interesting structure to photograph because every culture has it. It's everywhere. But it's in how it plays out. It's very liquid.
And how it's interpreted through different cultures. Mm-hmm. Now, the show that you had at the IMA, the Suburban Nation, that was an enormous show. I mean, the pieces were physically enormous. I mean, there was like a garage there. There was a balcony there. You know, all these enormous suburban pieces that were constructed or reconstructed inside the IMA galleries. Christopher West Presents is a fantastic gallery, but it's a little bit smaller. It could actually fit in most of your work. so I'm curious how what you're doing for your installation.
Well, it'll be a drawing on the wall.
Okay.
So actually, when Chris and I first started talking, you know, I got the plans. I knew the space, but I had, you know, four times too much work, you know, to really fit in the space.
Uh-huh.
And I had laid it all out. But when you go into a space, at least the way I approach a space, the work has to fit the space. I mean, I use the space as part of, you know, my medium. So this will have a line drawing on the wall that will go up, say, about 8 feet and about 16 feet wide, or would you say?
Yeah.
Yeah, about that.
Okay.
And it's off of some drawings that I found from, like, 1931, some architectural drawings and draftings.
Hmm.
So,
you know, Chris, I want to ask you about this because now into your fourth show, really with each show, it's the gallery itself has sort of become the installation in many ways from artist to artist. It's almost been like this interesting challenge to see interesting process to see the challenge that each artist has as far as interpreting your space.
There's something nice with having such an intimate space. It's not kind of. During the boom times of the past, you know, few years before the recession, everybody was going bigger galleries, huge, more galleries, and these very ambitious, enormous shows. So it's been kind of nice to kind of flip this on its head and work with artists from all over and say, okay, here's the footprint of the gallery. You know, how can we still make this a great show? And so far, I think we've been really successful.
Very cool.
Yeah, and I think also, I mean, you'd have to say that I think Christopher really looks and seeks out artists that are innovators, you know, and it's not about hanging, you know, 5 4x8 prints, you know, very small to fit in a space. But he's looking for people who kind of take a challenge, and he allows an enormous amount of freedom because he didn't see the complete show until about a couple hours ago. So it is, that's always just great to work with.
Well, I find artists that I admire what they're doing, you know, from the past up until now and looking forward to their future. So for me, it's not as much about, you know, finding one body of work and showing it. It's about how can I continue to work with some of these amazing artists and hopefully help foster their careers over a number of years.
Well, I want to look to the future a little bit as we think about the number of years. Emily, I do just have to ask you, I mean, you are living in Vegas now. You've been there at University of Las Vegas. You're the head of the sculpture program, is that correct? Now going on a year and a half, going into your second year there. Mm-hmm. And Vegas is such a wealth of interesting things to see and interpret and to, I would imagine, in some ways find inspiration from. You know, are you working on anything that's related to Vegas? I mean, I can't imagine that the way that you look at the world, you don't see things every day walking down the street to work or something.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, your first instinct is to dress everything in neon after you've been there. You know, I mean, it's just this intense, you know, your color palette changes, everything. I mean, I'm wearing hot pink today, and I always wear black, you know? So it's kind of like, you know, a shift. You know, it's funny, going to Vegas, coming from, you know, Chicago, my work was always about making the mundane a spectacle. And early on, I realized in Vegas, the spectacle is the mundane. And it's really kind of been an interesting way and interesting thing to navigate, because I think, you know, that the spectacle changes so rapidly. New buildings go up, they get torn down. I mean, there's this,
right.
It's a very transient, and there's no structure to it. It's just a very bizarre place. And so I do have a couple shows coming up, but one in particular, I really thought, okay, if I'm in Vegas, I need to really understand the city. And you hear everywhere that Vegas is the number one foreclosed city in America. And interestingly enough, I've done work with America's number one in the past. And I thought, okay.
Right, number one kitchen, number one, you know, different appliances. Right, sure.
Yeah, and I thought, you know, this could be an interesting exploration for me to really understand the city in the context of the Strip.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think the first thing you want to do is light everything. But really, I want to have a really solid understanding of what actually is there and understand it, if that's possible. But I'm doing America's number one foreclosed city, and I'm documenting every foreclosed home in the city of Las Vegas, which is about, so far, 37,000.
Well, good luck with that. So little time to, you know, spend in the casinos, that it sounds
not that much of a gambler, so, yeah.
Travis DiNicola with Emily Kinnerk and Christopher West. Emily's exhibit With Love, Dessau can be seen at Christopher West Presents throughout January. The gallery is located on Mass Ave in the Dean Johnson Building. More information can be found at ChristopherWestPresents.com. ChristopherWestPresents.com.
Hey, Sharon.
Yes, Trav.
You ever hear the joke about the little baby polar bear who asks his dad, "Dad, am I a polar bear?" And the dad says, "Yeah, you're a polar bear." And then he looks at him and says, "Then why am I so cold?"
No, I haven't heard it. How does it go? But I'm pumped.
It's kind of like that right now.
Well, I know, man. I know it's going to be hard to tempt people to come out of their cozy living rooms to, you know, unwrap from their snuggie and get their dog out of the snuggie and go out and do stuff. But
there's
some
still
hot
a lot of great
items
stuff
on
going
the calendar.
On. So what do you got for our calendar that we call?
What do we do to stay warm? Actually, here's something awesome. This coming Saturday night, the 9th, that is guaranteed to warm you up. Money back guarantee. I am just sure that they would offer that. It's Carnival Warm Up Brazilian Night at the Jazz Kitchen.
Hot.
It doesn't start until, you're ready for this, is a hot start time, 11 at night, goes to 3 a.m. So you have to be a certain kind of going out in the cold sort of person, but it's a celebration of the arrival of the Carnival season, the largest party on earth. You can sample the Brazilian national drink, and you can dance the night away to music by DJ Kyle Long at the Jazz Kitchen Saturday night, 11 p.m. to 3 a.m.
And speaking of carnival, that is what's going on with Dance Kaleidoscope this weekend.
That's right.
That's right. It's their World Music Carnival, and that continues Saturday night as well as Sunday at the IRT.
Healing Arts Indy has a new art exhibition. It is called, you'll love this, Mystery Meat.
Nice.
It includes photography, drawing, and sculpture by a handful of local artists, and you can join them to discover what exactly is in the cafeteria meatloaf. It's at the Healing Arts Indy Gallery, 805 South Meridian Street, free and open to the public. Gallery hours generously by appointment. Call Healing Arts Indy Gallery to find out more.
And up at the JCC Art Gallery, Jerry Points, Strokes of Color is an exhibit that goes on from now through February 19th. Jerry, who's been on our show, had a long career, a very successful career as an art teacher and graphic designer, and he has returned to the fine arts and started a whole new career, and so his spectacular oil paintings that feature a lot of great, very colorful landscapes are being shown up at the JCC, the Jewish Community Center on Hoover Road, now through the 19th.
Excellent. Ensemble Voltaire wants you to go coach class at a concert on Friday, January 15th, that's this coming Friday at 7:30, at Trinity Episcopal Church. Great 18th century music, coach class style.
Hey, this is pretty exciting. The Indianapolis City Ballet that did the incredible ballet performance featuring great ballet talents from all over the world last fall is starting a series of master classes for Indianapolis dance students. And, in fact, this starts on Sunday the 10th. Now, there's a lot of information here. There's a series of nine different master classes with great teachers from around the world that are coming in. It's open to both students as well as observers on a space available basis. Best thing to do is check out IndianapolisCityBallet.org right now to find out more information. But the opening class is being taught by that incredible dancer who did the David Parsons piece, Caught. If you remember that, he's going to be the first teacher of the first class.
Oh,
Miguel Quinones.
Yeah,
very neat.
Excellent.
So IndianapolisCityBallet.org.
Hey, what's the future of Indiana and the Midwest? Find out in Indie Talks, a citywide collaboration. WFYI is one of the partners. Google that and find out more about the live radio interview on January 13th with Richard C. Longworth, who wrote Caught in the Middle, America's Heartland in the Age of Globalism.
That's going to be a really cool series. Looking forward to hearing more about that. Well,
meanwhile,
we will be back next week
extra layers.
Once we warm up with more of
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
Dan Carpenter has been synonymous for many years with this Indianapolis journalist's op-ed columns in the Indianapolis Star. But there's another Dan Carpenter who uses poetry as a tool to make sense of the world. Sharon Gamble invited that Dan into our studios to talk about and read from his new book, More Than I Could See, Poems by Dan Carpenter.
Cost of Living. If it were not for the nightmare ecstasies, the resented children, the mothering women, the foreshortened life, all the shame and waste, and the one ruthless ruling priority, we wouldn't have Carver, as we wouldn't have Poe, Picasso, all the biggies. Who couldn't tell you the travel team tryout deadline, the 800 number for insurance, or which one wet the bed and from which nightmare? And there you have why you don't have much of me, or so the story could work, somewhere far from home, where I might be wondered about.
Do you remember the first poem that grabbed your attention, that made a sense of possibility for you that words could be shaped into poetry?
I could go back a long, long way, but I keep stopping in the early 90s when I was concentrating on newspaper work and writing polemics in opposition to the war and the first Gulf War. And I read a couple of poems by Denise Levertov in The Catholic Worker, of all places. One about religion and one about the war, and they both lit a fire under me because they showed that art, if you will, capital A, can take on large and even unfashionable subjects and set them to music. She seemed to compress everything I was after as a writer. That's probably halfway through my life inspired this as much as anything.
What's the relationship between journalism and poetry, in your life at least?
The immediate response is that one's craft and one's art. I have seen work in journalism, in daily newspapers, in radio features, that easily rose to the level of art. The principal difference, I guess, is that there have to be compromises made to reach a large audience in a hurry. And poetry forces people to slow down. It doesn't demand a large following, and it allows more personal eccentricity, I think, on the part of the writer.
Hmm. Actually, one of your quotations at the beginning of the book, I assume that you are the person to whom this was said, a local editor now long dead to a reporter facing deadline, "It ain't literature, kid." Was that to you?
That was not to me, but it was close. It was third hand. It was from a long retired, long deceased editor, and it was a favorite expression of another veteran reporter who shared it with me. And it raises, I don't think it resolves the issue of whether literature under deadline, if you will, can truly be literature.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, Jimmy Breslin and Joan Didion and a lot of Tom Wolfe, in particular, a lot of newspaper and magazine people, radio reporters, writers, have shown that it can be literature. But it was a good, healthy corrective against pretensions, I think, on this guy's part.
Matthew Arnold called journalism literature in a hurry. When you're writing poetry, of course, now I should ask you about your writing process for your columns. There certainly is the deadline pressure, maybe not so much if you were covering, the president's speech 2 hours ago or whatever, mm-hmm. where you really have to turn it around quickly. But is there an adrenaline rush? Is there a process? And if so, how does writing prose compare to writing poetry? I'm curious about the mechanics.
You can sit and let a poem simmer You don't have that luxury so much with newspaper work, although I'm not under nearly the daily deadline pressure that the people on the news side are. In the case of a piece written for the newspaper, you would fall back on things you've written before and information that has been accumulated beforehand, and use that as a base to work from. And you would have a specific event to be commenting on. In the case of a poem, it sounds precious to say this, but it would be more likely to land on you, and you know, in some incipient form at least, and then you would work on it at your leisure, mm-hmm. and let it kind of happen. I think you would have to force things more, and follow more formulas with the newspaper story, and be less, certainly less original line by line. There's much more to fall back on, I guess, in terms of formula, mm-hmm. and past knowledge and reader expectations.
There's a kind of community there that there isn't when you're writing poetry, isn't there?
That's true.
Or at least a different kind of community. And there's also an editor or multiple editors there who are going to poke and prod you and maybe encourage you to reshape sentences.
Yes, it is much more of a communal effort, the final product. Depending on the publication, a poem may get quite a bit of editing, but it's going to remain in your voice. That's going to be paramount, even to a pretty heavy-handed editor. And in a mass media production, you're going to be more part of the team, and you're not going to beat originality that hard, I guess.
Mm-hmm. I have to admit that I knowing your writing in the Indianapolis Star, I have developed a fantasy about how Obituary in Depth came about, and I'm going to ask you to read it, and then I'm going to tell you my backstory that I've created in my head and ask you if it's correct.
Obituary in Depth. Services will be held at 10 a.m. Tuesday in Engledow Chapter.
Start over. It's cool. That's what editing's for.
Yes, indeed. Obituary in Depth. Services will be held at 10 a.m. Tuesday in Engledow Chapel of Eternal Rest for Thomas Arthur Pence, who would never have believed a heart attack would take him at age 57, but who would have conceded that he was not altogether hostile to the idea of some sort of halt. Mr. Pence was born in Grand Rapids, Michigan, to the late Arthur and Estelle Hampton Pence, the latter of whom hoped a pregnancy might hold her marriage together. After learning of that plan and its failure while still a child, Mr. Thomas Pence maintained a formal relationship with his parents and a tentative grasp on his own existence. He moved with his mother to Indianapolis at age 12 and graduated from technical high school as a virgin. He earned a bachelor's degree in public accounting in 1969 from White River College, where he awakened his tendency toward alcoholism and acquired the only friends whose faces still could rise in his mind on the day of his death. Mr. Pence was an Army veteran of the Vietnam War, awarded an honorable discharge after suffering a nervous breakdown during preparations for a night assault in Khe Sanh province, which resulted in heavy American casualties, all of whose names he took care not to learn. From 1971 until the time of his death, Mr. Pence was employed as an inspector for the Indiana Department of Weights and Measures. Every morning during that period, Mr. Pence wished, for at least several moments, to be elsewhere. Every day while on duty, he did not drink. Mr. Pence married the former Virginia Marie Fletcher in 1975. She survives, along with a son, Thomas Arthur, Jr., who is not certain he does not hate Mr. Pence, a daughter, Rachel Virginia, Mrs. Leonard B. Holstead, whose husband Mr. Pence was right about, and two grandchildren, both beloved and feared for by Mr. Pence. The union between the deceased and his widow was consecrated in All Saints Episcopal Church for the purpose of securing a proper household for her and sparing him the risk he might someday die alone. Memorial contributions may be made to the church, where Mr. Pence donated weekly, the dollars feeling like paper onto a fireplace grate, Mr. Pence feeling never quite warm, even as a terrible joy surged from the sidewalk through his groin, his belly, his finely open throat.
What I like so much about this piece is the wicked humor that sets you up for this tragic ending. Was this, in fact, inspired by, back in the day before obituaries were paid editorial column inches, obituaries tended to be very formulaic and share just, you know, tidbits, bullet points. And I have a vision of you reading one of these and saying, oh, I want to read between the lines. Is that what happened?
Yes, that's it. What else is going on in that life and or went on in that life? And I turned my imagination to a piece of Americana, I guess, that I assumed readers who are not in my business would relate to. Even that term in the title, In Depth, it's a bit of a term of art, but I think the average person, even in the era of newspaper fadeaway, can relate to that. So I thought, it's one of the few prose poems I've written, and I thought the subject that it spun off from dictated that.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought I would see just how cute and just how poignant you might make something like this if you could just turn your imagination to it.
And it makes you, the next time you read an obituary, even though now they are sometimes prose poems, and depending on which bereaved family member writes them, I have to admit I've started saving them. I save them because in some cases I want somebody to write about me that way someday, and in some cases they're just so fascinating.
They are, and I love the terms that they use for die. There was one the other day about a person who caught the 6:30 a.m. chariot for glory. And it's beautiful in its own way. Yeah,
I love that.
They enter into rest, or they go and join God. And these are really lovely expressions that the old formulas couldn't handle.
No, not at all. Not at all. You've had, you're still a young man, but you've had a long career in journalism, and you often write about the forsaken, the disenfranchised, the forgotten, the little known. And it seems to me that in some ways, many of the poems in this book also attempt to elevate those folks. Not that you write a book of poems or any single poem with a goal, but did you have the sense in choosing the poems to put in this book that that's what you were doing?
That would have come naturally, I'm sure. It's been a privilege all these years to have this platform and to put marginalized people into the headlines and into the spotlight. And what I've loved about poetry is its capacity to exalt and to preserve what we think of as ordinary life and mean circumstances, and superficially forgettable people.
Yeah.
Poems flow naturally, I think, from the journalism in that sense.
I'm going to have you read one last one, a little bit on that note. It's In the Bank Line.
This is another that I thought a lot of people could relate to. Have we not all seen this and all stood there and just let it unfold? In the Bank Line. Somehow, the smiles, spreading from teller to teller, customer to customer, like a dish passed and savored, shared smirks of guileless pleasure, make the whole damn thing worse, an abrasion more hurtful than the blade of annoyance, of open disdain. Ah, this ageless spectacle, this tired stock scene, the confused old man, the smug young hireling, trading loudness and repetition, he from necessity, she for show, his hearing aid sufficient for me, but a license for her, his brave good cheer, his history, gone to waste on minds that time won't ripen, sown on a grandparentless culture of slate. Thank you for your patience, he says at last. That's okay, she sings songs, as if the grace were not all his, and her chance for grace, not tossed away in her not saying so, in her mischance to smile at him, and him only, slashing and scattering all the damn rest of us.
Sharon Gamble with poet and journalist Dan Carpenter. His new book is called More Than I Could See, Poems by Dan Carpenter. It's published by the Restoration Press and is available at BookMamas and Amazon.com.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 4.
I'll find out about the Rufus and Louise Ryberg reading series at IUPUI. And, of course, we'll have our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 for The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter is made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and by grants from the Arts Council of Indianapolis and from the City of Indianapolis and by support from the Central Indiana Community Foundation, the Indiana Arts Commission, a state agency, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, a federal agency. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.